Blue is going to tell us how to embezzle entangled states.
Perfectly.
Perfectly.
Thank you. What the talk is really about, in a way, is there's two models of how to represent bipartite things. One is that Alice and Bob should have separate state spaces, which we tensor product. And the other one is what's known as the commuting model. And there's currently a lot of research trying to understand the differences between these two models. And this is part of that, because what we look for is things that we can do in one model that we can't do in the other model to try to understand some separation. So what I want to show you today is that so first off, this is a joint work with Richard Cleave, Lou, and my student Sam Harris. So what we're going to do is show you that in the tensor product framework, you can't do perfect embezzlement, but that you can in this commuting operator framework. So this is something that separates the two, gives us a little wedge between the two models for how quantum mechanical systems should behave. I'm going to show you a way to look at it by using C-star algebras, which we think is really the most convenient way to study this, is by looking at states on algebras. And through that, we'll be able to show that this perfect embezzlement happens. And then what I'd like to do is take you back to these questions of Cyrilson about quantum correlation matrices and probability densities, and show you that what this is really some sort of parallels of the Cyrilson questions. Only there are parallels where we seem to be making faster progress in answering things. And the faster progress comes because we have these lovely embezzlement ideas. And then just to tie things back, I'll show you one non-local game, the coherent embezzlement game, that really goes back to Regev and Vidic, and how it can be viewed as an embezzlement game. So show you a game that you can win in one model perfectly, but not in the other model of quantum mechanics. So it's well known that if you start with a separable state and you do only local operations. Yeah.
I just had a general question about the background or the motivation for these two models. Is there some particular physical situation you have in mind? So, I mean, the example of the commuting thing seems to belong to quantum field theories or, you know.
Exactly.
Is that the kind of example?
Yeah, so, and when you think of the NPA hierarchy, it always converges to something in a commuting model, but people don't know if that can be represented in a spatial model. So these are the kinds of things we're trying to distinguish between these spatial, where you tensor product, and the commuting, which sort of rises from abstract field theory ways to look at things. And trying to drive a wedge between the two models to understand which one is a better presentation of physical reality. So in the end, this will tell you if perfect embezzlement can never happen any place in the universe, then you have to accept the commuting model. But if for some physics reasons you can argue it shouldn't happen, then that would be a reason to reject the commuting model as a proper model of how bipartite things act. Does that?
I see, yeah. Our different models might be for different situations.
Yeah, but we're just not, at this point in time, we're not really clear which is the better model for presenting things. The commuting model, oftentimes things work better and more easily in it. You've got these NPA things you can use. The tensor model sort of comes up from finite dimensional building up, and that's makes things bad because you never know when to stop in terms of how large you need the finite dimensional spaces to be. So we'll see some of those things as time goes on, as the talk goes on.
Everyone might think that there's a finite, I mean, for finite isolated systems of finite energy, you might think that ultimately they're all finite dimensional. But quantum field theory is a little less clear because,
right,
in some sense, it has to be infinite dimensional if you take it literally.
Right. And so mathematically, what we try to do is we try to find mathematical differences between the two models that, once we identify a mathematical difference, that will hopefully be useful to physicists at some point. So this one goes back to this work of Van Damme and Hayden, who you know you can't produce entangled things from separable things if you just have Alice and Bob acting locally. But they showed there's a way that, in a certain sense, it appears to produce entanglement by local methods. And hence, they used the term embezzlement to describe this, because it looked like you were getting entanglement in a situation where you shouldn't be able to. So let me explain what they did. They showed if you started with a catalyst vector, which generally has to be highly entangled, and it lives in some bipartite resource space. So Alice holds part of the space, RA, and Bob holds part of the space, RB. Then you could use local unitaries. So Alice's unitary only acts on her qubit space in RA, and Bob's unitary only acts on his qubit space in RB. And you start with this separable state, and you end up with something that looks, that's the Bell state, tensored with something that looks almost identical to where you started. So for numerical purposes, because these are so close together, you might mistakenly think they're identical as you're doing calculations. So in this way, it appears that you're getting an embezzled state. You're getting an entangled state in a way that you shouldn't be allowed to get an entangled state. So let me write that a little bit more precisely. So they each have a qubit space, and then we have RA, RB, and then there's a unitary that Alice acts on her half, a unitary where Bob acts on his half. And then when you do this unitary tensor the identity on Bob's space, identity on Alice's tensor the unitary to this separable part in their C2 tensor C2, it ends up here. They also proved bounds, that as epsilon goes to zero, you would need the dimensions of these resource spaces to tend to infinity. But that's left open the possibility that maybe if you allowed infinite dimensional resource spaces, then you could perfectly embezzle in this setting. And in fact, that's what people seem to think for a while, that by passing to infinity in some way, you could do perfect embezzlement in this kind of tensor model. But that actually turns out to be impossible. And it's just a little argument with Schmidt coefficients. So if you try to do this tensor product framework, you would never be able to achieve embezzlement perfectly, even if you allow the resource spaces to be infinite dimensional. And the argument is you take the catalyst vector, psi, and you do a Schmidt decomposition of it. So you write it as a summation of uj tensor vj with Schmidt coefficients out front, where the u's and the v's are orthonormal in their respective spaces. And then if you had these unitary operators that act locally, they would preserve Schmidt coefficients. But the Schmidt coefficients of what you're supposed to get out, which is this thing, are the old Schmidt coefficients duplicated and divided by root 2. And so it's pretty easy to see that These are the Schmidt coefficients of the output vector. They have to be the same as the Schmidt coefficients of the input vector, and can't happen. So if you try, even if you allow the dimensions to tend to infinity in the bipartite tensor model, you can never embezzle this Bell state perfectly.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
With the previous two slides back, one more. Is it true that when they were doing this, they found that the state psi was equal, or was it that they showed the distance was zero? Because in infinite dimensions, your distance measure can go.
Well, so in finite dimensions, if you try to do this, there's a bound on how close together psi and psi epsilon can be. Mm-hmm. And you need, if you want them to get closer and closer together, if you want the epsilon, the fidelity measure, any measure to go to zero, then the resource spaces have to grow unbounded in dimension.
Yes, my point is just that depending on what metric you use, when you go to infinite dimensions, your distance can go to zero independent of how actually close your states are. So
in finite dimensions, all metrics are more or less equivalent.
Sure, but as you go to infinite dimensions, that's where they kind of blow up.
Yeah. As you try to make the catalyst vector return nearer and nearer to itself, mm-hmm. then you see the dimension of the resource spaces has to be larger and larger, and you can get a actual functional relationship between their dimensions and how the whatever measure you want to use, fidelity measure, norm measure.
I think if the whatever measure you use, if it's strictly zero, then the two states are going to be.
So if whatever the measure is, if it's zero, then psi equals psi epsilon. It's just mm-hmm. if the fidelity is one, then psi and psi epsilon have to be the same. Or if the norm of psi minus psi epsilon is zero, then the psi and psi epsilon have to be the same. So maybe I didn't understand what you're asking.
I know, for example, that if you use a one norm versus a two norm, you can get different results. The two norm will go to zero, whereas the one norm will not.
As the dimensions grow,
yes.
But still you're forcing the dimensions to grow. Mm-hmm. So it's just the particular dimensions you'll need will be different depending on what measurement you use, what norm you use to measure the distance between them. But the point is, as you try to drive psi and psi epsilon closer and closer together, mm-hmm. the dimensions have to go unbounded. But yet the next slide shows that if you do allow them to be unbounded, but you still enforce this bipartite structure on the resource space, then you still can't do it. So it looked like perfect embezzlement was sort of impossible. Yet.
On your next slide, I'm still trying to understand your argument with the orthogonal decomposition. It might help, but how does the Van Dam-Hayden argument look in this language? What do the TJs have to look like in order for final state to be a good approximation, one entangled bit and tensor something?
So what happens is this psi epsilon will have different Schmidt coefficients.
So is it something very close to 1/2 and a whole bunch of small ones?
They have to stay. There has to be pairs of them that are close together, in order for this kind of thing to happen. So, the Van Dam-Hayden paper has exactly the formula showing the graphs of the Schmidt coefficients of the two vectors that you need, and they have to. They need to have this kind of. Periodicity built in. So you need the original vector to have two Schmidt coefficients which are sort of close together, and then those are going to become equal Schmidt coefficients in the perturbed vector. So there has to be it has to have Schmidt coefficients, which are close together in pairs. So you can have a perturbed vector where they're equal to the average, sort of. There's many constructions now of how to build this catalyst, this approximate catalyst vector. There's the original Van Dam Hayden construction, and then there's a construction by Leung and company, and then there's a construction by Cleave, which is in one of these papers that I'm citing, and all three have slightly different characteristics. The Van Dam and Hayden, because it was the first one, it's the most complicated, and these other ones are much easier to see why this phenomena happens.
I might be missing something here, but the argument on this slide seems to be that under this tensor product framework and applying these local unitaries, the Schmidt coefficients don't change at all. And
yeah. So if you
they can't ever
if Alice's unitary acts on this piece and Bob's unitary acts on this piece, then the image of this under a unitary will still be an orthonormal set, and this will still be an orthonormal set, and then you'll have the image vector written as TJ's orthonormal tensor orthonormal, and the Schmidt coefficients are unique up to any way you can express it as weights, orthonormal, tensor, orthonormal. That's what characterizes the Schmidt coefficients.
Right. So how do you get that?
So if I acted with a unitary here and a unitary here, the output vector would still have to have these TJs for Schmidt coefficients.
Sure, I understand.
But on the other hand, this vector, it's pretty easy to see that it has a representation, namely using 0, uj, vj, 0, and 1, uj, vj, 1, as a sum of orthonormal vectors. And in that representation, the Schmidt coefficients are appearing twice with weights 1 over root 2.
Did you say in the Van Dam paper that they plotted the Schmidt coefficients for the two cases?
For the psi and the psi epsilon. So remember, their psi isn't returned exactly. It's returned to something approximate. And
am I right that we get a contradiction here because there is an upper bound on the magnitude of, like, the largest of the TJs is whatever it is, and the largest of these Schmidt coefficients is that over root 2.
Over root 2.
But when we move to the infinite dimensional case, these can become densities, and that kind of argument's not going to go through.
The Schmidt coefficients are going to disappear, basically, in the commuting. So this is still infinite dimensional, but it's infinite dimensional bipartite. And as soon as you have bipartite, you can talk about Schmidt coefficients. And the Schmidt coefficients sort of act as a conservation principle. If you're preserving bipartite, then you still have to preserve Schmidt. But if you do commuting, there's no bipartite structure, so there's no conservation principle there. And that's what we're going to show, is that in this commuting model, you can do this exactly. And it's precisely because there aren't Schmidt coefficients acting as obstructions anymore.
So does this tensor product decomposition of, like, bipartite system only work for countable infinite spaces?
No, doesn't matter. The reason it doesn't matter is even if you're in an infinite dimension, uncountably infinite dimensional space, when you decompose things as sums of orthonormal vectors, only countably many coefficients can be non-zero. So you may as well be in a separable setting. So every time you have a vector in a non-separable space and you form a tensor product and you expand things, there will only be countably many coefficients that are non-zero. So you only need countably many basis vectors. So it's the fact that the TJs have to add up to 1, which forces countability on you, even if you put it in a non-separable space. OK, Okay, so here's here's an explanation of exactly what this commuting operator framework looks like. So we're just dropping this bipartite structure. So instead, we just ask for a resource space, and then Alice is going to have a unitary that acts on HA tensor the resource space, and Bob will have a unitary that acts on the resource space tensor HB. And if you think of them as operators on HA tensor R tensor HB, then we want them to commute. So it doesn't matter in which order you do the action, whether Alice acts first and then Bob, or Bob and then Alice. So pictorially, it's like this. Alice acts on her two pieces, Bob acts on his two pieces. And whether you do Alice first and then Bob second, or Bob first and Alice second, it's the same operator. It's the same operation. And we say that we have perfect embezzlement if in this framework, if when these two operators act on 0 tensor psi tensor 0, we get out the Bell state tensor psi. So I'm focusing on the Bell state here just for the purposes of presentation. You can embezzle any state, it turns out. Yeah.
You might think that a slightly different condition is what you would want. I suspect it's stronger than what you gives, but I can't see it fully. I mean, you might, if you were thinking in terms of quantum field theory, person A is over here and person B is over here, different regions of space or something, then you would think that A has access to some subalgebra of the full algebra of operators, and B has access to some algebra which is a commuting algebra. And A can do anything that's within the algebra, their algebra together with their, whatever you call it, HA algebra or the...
We're going to show that's equivalent to this in just a minute.
Oh, you're going to show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But first, so I wanted to describe
this. The answer is equivalent.
Yeah. Well, you'll see the sense in which it's equivalent, and then maybe that'll explain what you want to ask. So the key thing is you can do this perfect embezzlement if you use this commuting operator framework. And I'm going to show you why, and I'm going to show you the two commuting algebras that show up. And they play a role in our proof of this. So I'm going to outline the proof and show why this is tensor product framework is closely related to these Cyrilson problems and this Kahn embedding problem. So just for purposes of argument, let's say that Alice's space is Cn, and then I'm going to use this identification that when you do Cn tensor R, you can just think of that as the direct sum of n orthogonal copies of R. And if Bob has and in that case, it's natural to think of an operator that acts on Cn tensor R as an n by n matrix of operators where each operator acts on Br. So the idea is Uij is the piece of the operator that carries the jth portion of R to the ith portion of R. Okay. So anything that maps this space back to itself, there'll be operators that determine what happens in each of those sub pieces. And that's what the Uijs are. And we like to think in operator algebras in terms of operator matrices. And so this operator matrix, it would just act, you think of a vector as a column. And then you just do sort of ordinary matrix multiplication to determine the output. So what U sub A does to this vector H is it sends it to summation of U I J H J. That's the first piece, and then the nth piece. So for me, it turns out to be more convenient, instead of using tensor notation, to think of these operator matrix notations. And anytime you have an operator on n copies, it always has like a matrix representation. And then similarly, if Bob's Hilbert space is m-dimensional, he's going to have some matrix, operator matrix, VKLs, which act in the same way. And the little lemma is that this assumption that U sub A tensor id commutes with id tensor U sub B is exactly saying that the algebra generated by the entries of Alice's operator and the algebra generated by the entries of Bob's operator, that those are commuting algebras. So there's your commuting measurement algebras. They come from the entries when you view it as an operator matrix. So this last condition is what we will often refer to as star commuting. So it's not just that the U's commute, but actually their adjoints have to commute. And so we see that having these two unitaries in this commuting framework can just be all rephrased in terms of having operator matrices in this star commuting condition. And so now let me introduce you to the C star algebra way to approach this. We want to talk about abstract states in order to see what's going on. So there's this old C star algebra called the C star algebra of a non-commuting unitary. And that's exactly what we have going on here, because this whole big thing is a unitary. But because the entries are operators, the UIJs don't have to commute among themselves. So it's sort of like you're acting on the some sort of quantized version of the unitary group. Instead of having numbers here, which do commute, you have operator entries, which don't necessarily commute. And so he dubbed that the non-commuting unitary C-star algebra. And let me just explain what that means. So you just start with abstract generators. I'll write them with little letters, UIJ. And they should have the universal property that whenever you have actual operators on a Hilbert space giving you a unitary, then you can represent this algebra by sending the abstract letters, UIJ, to the concrete operators, capital UIJ. And that was his idea behind this. This is just a way to sort of quantize the ordinary group of unitaries. And now what we really have when we have Alice's operators and Bob's operators is we have the U's give us a representation of UNCN, and the V's give us a representation of UNCM, and those two representations are commuting. So in C-star algebra language, that's what's meant by the max tensor product of the two C-star algebras. It's a C-star algebra where the letters from the one commute with the letters from the other, but internally the letters don't have to commute. And then recall that an abstract state on a C-star algebra is just a positive linear functional that sends it sends positive elements to positive numbers, and it sends the identity to the number one. And so our theorem is that you can do perfect embezzlement of this Bell state exactly when there's a state on this abstract C-star algebra. We were looking at Alice's space being two-dimensional and Bob's space being two-dimensional. That's why it's a UNC2 in both cases. And what it has to do to the generators is it has to send them to the first two generators have to go to a 1 over root 2, and the last two, there's still more generators, but those other two generators have to go to 0. And if you can build, so the theorem is, if you can build a state on the algebra, an abstract state, then you can find unitaries that will do perfect embezzlement. And those two things are equivalent. And I'd like to sort of show you why. People were asking me earlier today about GNS, and this is exactly the kind of thing it's useful for. That the GNS says anytime you have a state, you can build a Hilbert space and a representation of the algebra's operators on that Hilbert space so that it emulates the state. And so what we do is if we have this state, then by GNS we get a representation and a canonical vector psi, and it'll turn out that psi is exactly what acts as the embezzlement vector, the catalyst vector for the state. So first we reduced whether or not we can do it down to whether or not there is such a psi, such a state. And then we show that the Van Dam-Hayden improximate embezzlement gives us a sequence of states which in the limit do exactly these numbers. And so that's the way that in the commuting model we can take limits. So it's a different way of taking limits. The one way you're starting with concrete spaces and you're trying to take limits of the spaces, you can't do that. But if you model things as states on an algebra, then you can take limits of states to get a new state. And then from that new state, you can build a Hilbert space that does exactly the things you want. Only the Hilbert space won't have a bipartite structure because it just comes from this GNS construction, and there's no way to build the bipartite into that construction. So that's the outline of why these things work. And so what I'd like to do next is go through what this has to do with things you might have seen in the past. Yeah, so I'll skip the rest of that. And the thing is, we see that this representation we're getting, we know it can't decompose as a spatial tensor product because we've already seen that perfect embezzlement is impossible if we decompose things in a spatial way. And so like I said, we want to draw the analogies with what people have been studying who study Tsirlson's conjecture and quantum correlation matrices. So just do a little reminder of all those things. So the idea is you have Alice and Bob. They each have n quantum experiments, and each experiment has m outcomes. I want to just keep the same number for the number of experiments and the same outcomes for both of them. Just keep the notation simpler. And in that case, you get conditional probability densities, where P, A, B, X, Y, it represents the conditional probability that Alice gets outcome A and Bob gets outcome B, given that they perform experiments X and Y. And so there's several different models for what these could be. And that's the first and most basic is that we imagine that they each have a finite dimensional state space, one for Alice, one for Bob. For each experiment, Alice will have a projective measurement. So that'll be projections EXA, which as you sum over outcomes, add up to the identity operator. Ditto for Bob. And then they share some generally entangled state in their joint Hilbert space, so that when you do the measurement EXA tensor FYB against that state, that's giving you your probability, your outcomes. And so the set of all these is what's usually meant by the set of quantum conditional probabilities. And that's, I like to denote that by C sub Q, Q for quantum, C for conditional. It's all the tuples you can get that way. So that's some subset of R n squared m squared. And all the Tsirlson problems and the Bell inequalities are all about trying to understand the exact geometry of that set. So there are two other models you could use. you could just allow, relax the condition that HA and HB be finite dimensional. So I'll denote that by Q sub S for spatial. And then the third model is you just look at the assumption that there is a Hilbert space on which Alice and Bob both get to act, but because their actions are separated, their measurement operators should commute. And then you have a state vector, and you do the same thing. You do the product of the operators applied to the state vector, you trace it out. So Cyrilson was the first to examine these sets and study the relations between them. And in fact, back in the 80s, he thought that all these sets were the same. And it was only in the 90s that people discovered there were some gaps in his reasoning. And we now know these sets don't have to be the same, but we're still trying to unravel what is the relationship between all of them. So here are some of the things that we know and don't know after 20-some years of thinking about these sets. So the first thing is obvious, that CQ is the smallest, QS is bigger, and QC is the largest of the three. We still don't know if the set CQ or CQS is closed, but we do know that the largest one is closed. So the fact that they're not, we don't know these other ones are closed, means when you want to do what are known as values of non-local games and all, you define those to be soups. But you sort of all know that a soup doesn't have to be attained on a set unless the set is closed. So so we don't really know if values of games are attained for non-local games because we don't know those sets are closed. Some of you have probably heard about work on the I-3322. That's one game where it's conjectured its value is not attained, and that would be a way to prove that CQ is not closed. And there's been a lot of work along those lines, not very successful yet. We do know if we close up the two smaller sets, they're actually the same, and that that can be identified as states on a minimal tensor product. Werner and Schultz conjectured about 10 years ago that CQS was actually the closure of CQ. We still don't know if that conjecture is true or not. And then operator algebras got involved when, through work of, the first group is Younga, Nevesquez, Perez Garcia, Carlos Palazuelos, and then Werner and Schultz, and then later another operator algebraist by the name of Ozawa proved that if the closure of this one set is CQC, that's true for all possible N's and M's, if and only if a problem in operator algebra is called Kahn's embedded conjecture as an affirmative answer. So I don't want to try to tell you what Kahn's embedded conjecture is about today, but it's one of the choke points in operator algebra theory. There's about five things that if we could prove Kahn is true, then we could prove they're true. And so there's been intensive work on it for 30 years, 40 years. But now we recognize, due to this work, that it's really at heart the same as the problems that Cyrilson was getting after, trying to identify similarities or differences between these different models for what a probabilistic quantum correlation should be. And then just recently, the sort of best result that we have is we at least know that CQS is not equal to CQC. So if you parse all this, if Werner and Schultz were correct and those two sets are equal, then this would show that this closure is not equal to CQC, and that would prove that Kahn is false. So these two conjectures are, you can't hold both of them in your head at the same time. If one is true, the other has to be false because of Slofstra's result. And that's sort of where we're at right now. in terms of our knowledge of how these sets look. So,
could you just repeat the definitions of the three sets?
So one, you take your projective measurements, you tensor them, everything is on a finite dimensional space, and you do against a state. The slightly larger one with the S is when you allow the spaces HA and HB to be infinite dimensional, but you still are demanding this bipartite structure. And then the largest is when you just do the axiomatic quantum field theory way of saying their measurement operators should have to commute and live on some common Hilbert space. Okay. Now I'd like to show you the sort of parallels. So what my student Harris has been able to show is that this Kahn embedding is true exactly when this min and this max tensor product of these non-commutative unitaries are the same. Probably not so interesting for us. He's also shown it's enough to just show it in the case n and m equals 2. But then he also showed it's the same as exactly like we had on the earlier page, that something he calls unitary correlations, their closure should be equal to the commuting version of unitary correlations. So I want to explain what these kinds of correlations are and show you where we know about those and sort of do them in parallel to what we just did on the last slide. Last four sentences are for the operator algebras crowd, so let me just skip that. So here's the way we'll form unitary correlations. What we want to do is take operator matrices like this, which give a unitary, but where each entry is just living on some finite dimensional Hilbert space. So they're P by P matrices or Q by Q matrices. And they form a block unitary. So you just think of it as you have in the first case, you have a PN by PN matrix, which is partitioned, and the big matrix is a unitary. And then you look at each of the entries in the partition. And then you have some vector, and you want to take the Uij, the VKL, you want a tensor, and you want to apply those to the vector. So that's all doing bipartite things on finite dimensional spaces. And looking at all the possible correlations you can get of entries of two block unitary matrices. So these are really n squared, m squared tuples. Sometimes it's convenient to think of them as n by n tensor m by m matrices. QS would be the same thing, except we drop the assumption that the Uijs and the VKLs act on finite dimensional spaces. So it's still, but it's still a bipartite. There's still a space held by Alice, a space held by Bob. And then UQC is we just have them all acting on a common, generally infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and the U's should star commute with the V's. So exactly what we had in the commuting operator framework. And again, we form all the correlations we could get by bumping those operators up against a state vector. And so we get these sets of n squared by m squared tuples, three different sets of them. And here's the things we do know, don't know about those. So just like if I didn't have the U in front, the three are contained. In the probabilistic correlations, we don't know whether these, if I drop the U, we don't know if those sets are closed or not. But in this setting, we know that none of them are closed. As soon as N and M are bigger than or equal to 2, they're never closed. Again, just like the UC case, the C case, that set is closed. We do know that the closures of the two smallest ones are equal, and they can be identified with states on a tensor product. And here's the thing that's the analog of Slostra's result. Already at the smallest case, where n and m are equal to 2, we know that the spatial and the commuting correlations you can get this way are not equal. So, and it's a consequence of the embezzlement results that we talked about earlier. And we also, just to reiterate, we know studying whether the closures of these sets are the same is, again, the same as this Kahn embedding. So we've got a way to sort of translate everything about probabilistic correlations. There's a parallel universe of these unitary correlations. And we see that we can say good things about these unitary correlations by using this embezzlement method that kind of evolved from the work of Van Dam and Hayden. So let me close just by going back to a sort of game. This was introduced by Regev and Vidic. It's also known as the T2 game. And show you what this says in that case. So here's the game. The referee prepares one of two states. They're both in HA tensor HB. So Alice and Bob each have their separate spaces. And it's going to be one of these two states. And then Alice and Bob, after they receive this common state, they only get to act on their spaces, but they have to somehow produce output a classical bit. And they win the game if whenever the output is even, the sum of the classical bits is even, and whenever the input was odd, the sum of the classical bits is odd. And so that's their goal, to try to do that. And what are the rules of the game? Well, they're allowed to operate with unitaries on their portion of the space to manipulate this state in some way, and then somehow, after they've done that, produce their output. So they're still, they're sort of living in separate non-communicating universes because they can only act on their half of the space. And so what do we know about this game? Well, so here's all the things I just said before. If you assume they're allowed to share a state in some resource space and act with unitaries on the resource spaces, then the theorem is there is a perfect strategy. Namely, there are unitaries Alice can use and unitaries Bob can use that will give them a way to win this game every single round. But if you demand that this resource space be in bipartite structure, and they can only act on their half of the space in that sense, then they can't win this game, even if they're allowed to have infinite dimensional resource spaces. Why is that? Well, this game, it turns out, is embezzlement in reverse, if you think about it carefully, because they're starting with this thing that looks sort of like something embezzled, and they've got to unembezzle it to win the game. And if you stare at the game long enough, you'll see it's really, to win it, you would have to do embezzlement in reverse. But unitaries are reversible. So if you can embezzle perfectly, you can unembezzle perfectly. And if you can't embezzle perfectly, you can't unembezzle perfectly. And that's basically the proof of why this game is winnable in one model, but not in another model. And so you can reduce this game to saying you can win if and only if you can find numbers satisfying certain properties in these unitary correlation sets. So that's that's all I wanted to say. So the, just to sort of wrap it up, we see that these classic problems about probabilistic correlation sets are closely tied to these unitary correlation sets. Techniques from embezzlement allow us to produce some elements of these unitary correlation sets. And we're continuing to study the geometry and try to understand these unitary correlation sets for that reason. And we see that there are at least there are some games that we can decide if they have perfect strategies or not by looking at these unitary correlation sets. So so what I think should be possible is there should be these unitary correlation sets should be exactly the right thing to look at when you want to study these games which have finitely many quantum inputs and finite classical outputs, that somehow deciding if such games have perfect strategies, deciding values of such games should be related to functionals on these space of unitary correlations in the same way that for classical finite input, finite output games, their values and all are determined by functionals on the classic probabilistic things. And that's projects we're trying to work out currently. So understanding the geometry and trying to see how to use these correlations for this family of games. Well, sorry I ran a little bit over, but thanks for your time.
Still have 4 minutes, actually.
Oh, I thought it was a 50-minute shut off.
Questions?
Yeah. Belen?
Yeah, so, I have two questions, actually. So the first one is, do you have any strong opinion or feeling of which is the correct way to model actually these bipartite situations? And my second question, which is closely related, is do you also have any intuition of whether we should expect this investment to be something realized from nature?
Yeah, well, the quantum commuting is mathematically better to use. You've got this NPA hierarchy, mm-hmm. So you can do things using semi-definite programs to approach it from, estimate it from above. The standard quantum, for each finite, each time you take HA to be a fixed finite dimension and HB to be a fixed finite dimension, you get a subset of the quantum correlations. But then it's the union from below of those. And that's the problem. When you union up closed sets from below, you don't know if the union will still be closed. So some ways the QC is nicer to work with. But of course, the best possible thing, if the union from below closure is the same as the descent from above via NPA hierarchy, and that's exactly, we now know, that's exactly true if and only if con is true. So it's equivalent to all these other things that have been obstructions to us. Which is the proper model? I don't know. Many people, when they see perfect embezzlement, they say that should never be allowed to happen. So they say, so this commuting model should be discarded because of that.
Which is not.
I'm not a physicist, so I don't have any skin in the game.
Maybe a comment on that. I mean, there's a lot of kind of information processing situations where you want to give players free entanglement. So in that sense, there should be no problem with allowing embezzlement. That's embezzling states up to one getting used as a resource in some situations as well. So.
Yeah, but the question is that actually possible or not?
Or would there be a situation where embezzlement would allow you to make things that you shouldn't in principle?
Well, sometimes it lets you prove nice theorems. And so
yeah.
There you can.
Yeah.
Based on
that's my feeling. QC is better for proving theorems. It's the smooth theory, but it may not be what represents physics. And I'm not the proper person to ask that question. All I can do is give you some mathematical consequences of the two different ways to view reality and say, here's something that maybe is something you can test to see which is possible and which isn't.
So the slide where you had the diagram of the UA and UB commuting.
Yeah.
Can you go back to that? Just as a prop. So
maybe I should just draw it on the board.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. Yeah. So this kind of thing comes up in another context, but it's a totally finite dimensional context, and I'm curious whether there's any connection between what you've been talking about and this other topic. So imagine I put a box around both those guys and said, look, there's some unitary from ARB to ARB, and I want to know what constraints does that unitary have to satisfy
decompose.
If A does not signal to B and B cannot signal to A. Okay, so meaning no matter what I input into A and no matter how I prepare R and B, the reduced density operator at the output of B doesn't depend on what I put into A and vice versa.
Yeah.
So I think it was Schumacher and Westmoreland proved that the condition under which A doesn't signal to B and B doesn't signal to A is exactly this one. It is possible to write the whole unitary as a UA composed with UB in either of these two forms.
Recursive
then? I'm sorry?
Recursive then?
That's called a, I think
that they don't need to be the same unitaries for one ordering and the other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I have a paper on archive with my student Harris, and we discuss unitary correlations which are non-signaling.
In both directions.
Yeah. I think it's exactly what you're saying. But we show that these are strictly bigger family than the ones that can come out of this commuting situation.
Okay.
So you can look in there and see if these are the ones you met or not.
They don't have to be the same.
Okay, so I believe the causal, what they call the causal maps, are a bigger family. Mm. But it still makes me wonder, are some of the techniques you described here sort of useful for exploring these causal maps? Let me give you
We didn't think in terms of this decomposing. That's a very pretty question.
Let me give you one other example of something this reminds me of. So there's a paper by Hayden and Petz in Winter on if I have a joint state over ABC such that the conditional mutual information between A and B given C is zero, what form must that state take? And what they show is that the Hilbert space of B, if it factorizes into two pieces and B left is correlated with A and B right is correlated with C, then you have this conditional mutual information being zero. But more generally, B could decompose into a direct sum of products. And all you really need is that the left pieces of every element of the direct sum are correlated with A and the right pieces are correlated with C. And that's the most general form. So it boils down to saying, look, I can write the whole state as sort of a product of an AB operator and a BC operator that commute. But this is all finite dimensional. It's just a situation where the criteria on B is not factorization, but more factorization within subspaces. So it feels like it ought to be connected, but there's obviously nothing here to do with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces.
Right. Well, the same thing if you do this commuting model, but you demand that R be finite dimensional, then you get the same sort of decomposition. Then R decomposes as a direct sum of tensors. And so it's probably related in that way.
So in this example you gave where you can, where you got these subalgebras, you managed to achieve this perfect embezzlement in this commuting framework or whatever it's in your algebra.
Yeah.
So what kind of algebras are there? In the classification, like type 1, type 2, type 3.
Well, that's why we introduced these non-commuting unitaries, because that's exactly what the algebra is, right? The algebra generated by Bob's unitary is the algebra generated by these UIJs acting on the resource space. And that's an image of this non-commuting unitary C-star algebra. And this one is very nasty. It's very similar in spirit to free group C-star algebras. And it has all the same problems that they have. It's not known if it satisfies properties that usual C-star algebras satisfy. So it's known it's not nuclear. It's not known if it has property WEP. I mean, these are just buzzwords from operator algebras, but it's in terms of, from an operator algebra's standpoint, it's a very hard C-star algebra to classify. It doesn't fit in the regular classification schemes.
Well, but when you represent them, then they're concrete. In the end, you have concrete operator algebras, don't you?
Right.
So there's
right.
some sort
but
of
the but that concrete number. That concrete operator algebra is a representation of this UNC, and it could be a faithful representation of it. So it could be that bad.
Uh-huh. But then there will be some von Neumann algebra associated with those two concrete. So isn't there some sort of type classification, type 1, type 2, type 3? So would you know if it's not type 1, I presume?
It's not type
but
1.
Is it any other type, or is it just a mixture of type?
It's probably a type 3, but I don't know if it would be a 3 lambda, or if it's...
Because I think what's known for the free quantum field theories is if you take these wedges, as they're called, or quadrature, draw a picture, but... you get type 3 algebras. The operator, the algebra associated with each of the wedges, which you could think of as like an experimenter who has access to half of space, and not half of space at one moment of time. That's intuitively what it's trying to be. That's supposed to be type 3.
Yeah.
So if you, I'm just trying to think how to make contact with some real physical situation where this kind of resource would be or might be available.
Right. If you look at the probabilistic correlations, they're all representations of these free group algebras. And if you take the reduced free group algebra, it's type 2. But when you do a general representation of the free group algebra, it can have pieces in its representation which are type 1, type 2, and type 3. And so the decomposition doesn't work so well for the general representation. And I suspect the same thing here. You could have a general representation, could probably be any of the types contained within it.
So you
suspect
it's just some mixture of all the
types? Yeah. Yeah.
The two scenarios that you described for embezzlement, to me it seems that they are fundamentally different in the sense that in one, a portion of attribute space is available, or of resource space is available to Alice and another portion to Bob. But in the other one, the full Hilbert space is available to both of them, but with the condition that...
that they commute. Yeah.
So I guess then I would expect that even in the finite dimension, we would expect different results of these two scenarios because
well, in finite
dimensions,
in finite dimensions, if the resource space is finite dimensional, it really is just the same as if the resource space is bipartite. And the reason is that you can show it decomposes as a direct sum of bipartite spaces. So whenever you do these things finite dimensional, usually you don't exactly get that it's bipartite, but you get that it's a direct sum of bipartites. And then you can always sort of build that using a slightly larger dimension, and you can embed that inside something bipartite. It's sort of like a purification.
So you're saying that this non-commuting model can be converted to some bipartite?
If R is finite dimensional, yeah. So one way to think of it is you ask what are the correlations you can get out? And if you do this commuting and you restrict the R to be finite dimensional, then the correlations you get out, these unitary correlations, are exactly the same as the ones you'd get from finite dimensional.
Okay.
guess if you said not just finite dimensional, but of a specific dimension, then, so if it's like as far as a qubit, it can't be, you know, factored into two pieces. But I could sort of define a classical algebra, which I can copy, so I can set up classical correlations between A and B using a qubit R. So I think maybe if it's some given finite dimension, that this purification, you know, might have too big of a dimensionality.
Right.
And therefore, we
right.
have to look at the factorization into direct sum structure.
Yeah, it's that whenever you try to factorize it in the direct sum structure, whatever the dimension of R is, it would have to be the sum of the products of the dimensions of the pieces. So when it's two, there's no way to write that as a sum of products unless it's a two times one or two one times ones. And so it's that same sort of thing you run into, you know, when you're doing group representation theory. You have this a formula here that would tell you what the possible dimension pairs are based on whatever this integer is.
So you have a kind of task which discriminates between these two types of approaches. I wonder if you could find a sort of principle that discriminates. And so here's an idea for a principle. So suddenly, in the case of finite dimensions, you can instead of looking at quantum theory or operator spaces and so on, you could look at general probability theories. These are theories where you represent states by lists of probabilities. So it's a bigger class of physical theories, and quantum theory, at least for the tensor product case, can be put into that framework. And a principle that you can consider is the principle of topographic locality. So that says that you can determine the global state for a bipartite system by making measurements on this side and measurements on this side and looking at the correlation, the joint probabilities. So at least the joint probabilities will determine the state. So that principle of local topographic locality in a finite case at least seems to be equivalent to saying that it's a tensor product. And that's in the context of this GPT, this general probability theory, not specifically for quantum theory. I don't know if that statement goes through in the infinite dimensional case, but it may be the sort of refinements on that kind of statement that will give you the reason case as well. But it seems like that might be an alternative approach to trying to discriminate between these different types of theory.
Are you saying, Lucien, in which you can ask for each of those frameworks whether or not it satisfies
and
then that would be a
principle.
Regard that as something we like.
Yeah, principles.
Then you could maybe discriminate.
Because tasks are useful for driving a wedge, but principles are useful for constructing theories. So maybe that's a more solid kind of thing that we can use as physicists to.
So are you suggesting that topographic locality might fail in the community?
Yeah, I'm suggesting that. I don't know for sure because I've never really thought about it in the infinite dimensional case. But it does. The topographic locality in the finite case does give you the tensor product.
Okay.
So it's at least possible.
Well, here's a question that might pertain. So if you look at quantum mechanics over the reals, topographic locality fails.
Right.
So have you given any thought to questions of these separations for
No. Because then you'd want to do something, for us, you'd want these to be orthogonal matrices
right.
instead of unitaries. Maybe that's a better model, I don't know.
I think if you could show something in the sphere of real quantum mechanics, it could be low-hanging fruit, maybe everything goes through. And then it would directly answer, I think, some of these questions. Well, we give some insight as to what it might mean for the model.
Is tomographic locality even defined outside of bipartite scenarios?
Yeah, you can define it for multipartite scenarios.
But
you mean the commuting scenario?
Yeah.
Well, that would require some thought. I think it should be. You should be able to ask the question of can I determine the state, global state, just by making local measurements on each system. And, yeah, I think it's defined. I don't quite see how to. When you have when you require an infinite number of measurements on each side, there may be some problems. behind you, but
why?
Well, just any time I see the number infinity,
oh, I
get worried.
but even for bipartite, there's infinity.
Sure. Yeah, and in that case also. Yeah.
Oh, I see. This is just something that came to mind when you were talking about the relationship to the correlations, possible correlations. So everything here more or less was a probabilistic, I mean, question to match the probabilities, although your actual task had nothing probabilistic about it.
Yeah.
So there is a set of correlations that also, you know, for example, distinguish classical from quantum case. And they don't involve probabilities, they involve only perfect correlations. So they have names like the Hoken-Specker example, the GHZ example of Dudalusian. All of these are cases where there are certain perfect correlations that quantum mechanics built in that could not have been achieved, in some sense, classically. I wonder if there's something like that here, you know, whether there's ones that are proper to infinite dimensions. You know, does the infinite dimensional thing bring up new ones of this sort?
Yeah, well, we've tried that many different ways. I mean, one way is, you know, when you look at local games, that's kind of a way to get a very combinatorial thing of what you can do in the two different models. But so far, we haven't, you know, really been able to separate things with any kind of non-local game yet. But that's kind of the spirit behind people who are trying to separate these probabilistic correlations using various kinds of non-local games, is that that would be some higher order combinatorial thing that might see a difference between the two models.
So you looked at that, but so far?
Yeah, well, I've done a lot of work on what we call quantum chromatic numbers of graphs, and there's a classical quantum one, and there's a quantum commuting one, and we were hoping that we'd find a complicated enough graph that would separate these two chromatic numbers arising from the two different models. And so far, no luck. We can't prove they're the same for all graphs, but we can't find any graphs that detect a difference.
Well, what about separating infinite from finite dimensions? Are there, can that be done?
Well, here we generally were assuming finitely many inputs and finitely many outputs. So, do you mean maybe if we allowed?
You had this, what did you call it? CQ, CQS, and CQC. Isn't there an analog of separating CQ from CQS in these games?
To try to do that, but it hasn't been successfully done yet. The only separation that's happened is this Slofster result, which separates CQS from CQC. So there's only two of the things in the hierarchy that have been separated at all so far.
This is more of a comment, but I wonder if there's a classical analog of these sorts of questions. So rather than focusing on unitaries, you could look at symplectic transformations. This is not something that we tend to, it's not the kind of comparison that we tend to make in quantum information theory. In quantum information theory, we say, oh, the analogs of unitaries are just, you know, any bijective map on the classical state space. But from a physicist's perspective, it makes more sense to look at symplectic transformations. And then you could imagine a scenario where maybe you have some restriction. So instead of quantum states, you have probability distributions over the classical state spaces wherein you only know the values of some Poisson commuting set of observables. So there's kind of a way of sort of getting classical analogs of your quantum states. And then you could ask, well, what sorts of probability distributions could I get to from that class together with symplectic transformations? And it's not obvious to me that there isn't a kind of analogy to this distinction you've been talking about, commuting versus tensor. But it might be something interesting to think about.
Yeah.
what's the analog of a tensor product? Like, take a Cartesian product. I'm guessing commutation means Poisson commutation.
Well, yeah, but when you're at the level of probability distribution, so the space of probability distribution is on two classical state spaces, is the tensor product of the space of distribution on each space.
So it's also in this GPT framework, although the symplectic transformations.
The symplectic transformations, are a kind of constraint on the GPT transformations. But, you know, unlike the GPT framework, which where maybe the analogy is to quantum theory, you know, it's maybe not so obvious, that here, kind of, it's sort of clear what the analogy to unitaries will be. And given that a lot of your construction does depend on the unitary group, it feels like maybe it would carry over if I just, you know, replace that with a symplectic group. But yeah, I don't understand whether there really is this gap between the tensor product and computing.
If there are no more questions, maybe we can start now.
Let's thank the speaker.